Hey everybody, welcome to Buzzing About Romance. On this episode, we are doing a quick shot of romance, author spotlight edition. And on this spotlight, I am joined by author Candy Steiner. Candy Steiner is a number one Amazon best-selling author and whiskey connoisseur, now living in Tennessee, best known for writing emotional roller coaster stories. She loves bringing flawed characters to life and writing about real, raw romance in all its forms. An alumna of the University of Central Florida, Candy graduated with a double major in creative writing and advertising / PR with a minor in women's studies. You were quite busy in school. She took particular interest in writing romance after college, as she has always been a die-hard, hopeless romantic. She particularly loves cinnamon roll heroes who fall hard for their strong-willed woman. When Candy isn't writing, you can find her reading books of all kinds, planning her next adventure, or pole dancing. Yes, I spoke that right, and you read it right. She enjoys live music, traveling, hiking, yoga, spending time with her family, and soaking up the sweetness of life. Welcome to the podcast, Candy.
Thank you. I didn't know you were going to read the whole bio. Sorry that I put you through that.
Oh, that's okay. Like I said before, well, I guess you know you wouldn't know this, but I am getting over the flu, so I'm channeling my inner Phoebe Buffay today. So if I sound weird, that is why.
That is one of my favorite episodes of Friends, by the way. I love when she has her sexy, sick voice.
I know. I actually want to like bust into Smelly Cat like every like so often.
Yes.
But I don't, because nobody wants to hear me sing in the first place. But maybe I'll sing it to my kids later and see if they like it.
Oh, that's how I feel. I sing all the time to Rosie and she loves it. And I'm like, one day you're going to grow up and realize that your mother is a terrible singer, but I'm so happy that it entertains you right now.
Well, we will be at church singing, and my oldest will be like, and we have a choir, and he's like, do you want to join the choir? I'm like, nobody wants to hear that. He's like, nobody cares. I'm like, oh, they would care.
They would care.
I'm I would like, be thanks for the support, buddy.
I would be insufferable if I actually could sing well. Like if I could actually carry a tune, I would be like, we're going to karaoke every night. Oh, you guys want to sing in the song? Great. Or like in the car? Great. Let me pick the music. Oh, do you guys want to sing this? Let's do the sing-along. I would be singing nonstop because I love music, but I am not musically talented at all.
I do the sing-alongs in the car and I get the faces. But I also like car singing. You just have to sing like all out and there's no like niceness to it or prettiness to it. Yeah, I just get the looks. I'm like, it is my duty as your mother to embarrass you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm like, my parents did it. It's my job now. Oh, excuse me. So what initially drew you to romance as a writer, like in itself, like aside from like reading romance?
Yeah. So, I mean, gosh, I've been a hopeless romantic what feels like my whole life. When I was younger, just the movies I watched, and I would play Barbie dolls, and it was always about falling in love, Ken and Barbie, and all their drama that they would have. But writing specifically, I went, as you just read, went to college for creative writing, and I thought I was going to write primarily nonfiction. That was where my heart was. It was what I loved to write the most. It's where I studied the most. I actually didn't even take my first fiction course until I was a senior because I was like, ugh, I guess I have to take a fiction course now. And I remember taking it and having so much fun and realizing that the process of building characters and like you can write about the things I wanted to write in nonfiction, right? Through fictional characters, you can still explore all the themes that I wanted to. And I really enjoyed it. And when I graduated, I started reading for fun again, instead of just reading all the textbooks and things that I had to read in college. And I just dove straight into like, I did 50 Shades of Grey and I really loved it. I did Hunger Games and Divergent series. And then a friend of mine recommended, she was like, have you ever read indie romance books? And I was like, I don't even know what that means. So she sent me a recommendation for a Jay Sterling book called The Perfect Game. And I loved it so much. And it just turned on this tap in my mind. And it was like this dripping of water of these ideas that just eventually started to become like a waterfall that I couldn't shut off. And so that's kind of where I decided maybe nonfiction is not for me. And maybe romance is my jam.
So what, like, as you're writing, because clearly you've been writing forever, like, why did you decide to publish? Like, what made you decide to publish? Or was that always the goal?
It was definitely always the goal for me. I mean, I have wanted to be an author since I was in the third grade. But I definitely thought it was going to be more, again, in the nonfiction realm. I kind of imagined writing about my experiences growing up and sort of the domestic hardship that we faced and growing up in rural Oklahoma and kind of how that shaped me and addiction in my family, like that kind of stuff was where I thought I was going to be going. But when I kind of switched over to romance, it started with my first book, Tag Chaser, which is still published and out there. It's terrible, I think, in my opinion now. But if you want to read where I first started off,
I feel like every author like says that their first book was the worst.
it's like cringy sometimes when I think about it, because I was figuring out my way, right? It was my first time doing it. So, but you can read that if you want to. And I wrote that book as a New Year's resolution. I told my friends I am going to write a book and I'm going to publish it on my 24th birthday. That's my goal. And that's what I did. And I still love it for the part that it played in my journey. That's why I'm not taking it off sale, even though I think it's kind of terrible. But it's an important part of how I got to where I am today. And so, I appreciate the readers that it brought me. It started everything.
Is there a piece of advice like present you would give past you?
Writing specifically? Oh, so much advice.
I have been asking every author this question because I think it's so interesting to hear their answer.
It is, I could probably talk this whole hour about advice I would give past me. If I had to boil it down to one thing, though, I think I wish I could have told 24 or 23-year-old me, hey, this actually isn't a pipe dream. It's something that's within reach. So don't just treat this as art, treat it as a business from the start. Because for years I didn't. For years it was just I write what I want to write, I market it the way I want to market it, and I think if I would have understood the way that writing ties into a business when you make the choice to independently self-publish better, I would have made a lot of different decisions that could have potentially, gotten me somewhere quicker or perhaps changed some paths. But in the same breath, I am definitely one of those woo-woo people that feels like everything happens for a reason, and everything in my career has led me to this moment where I am now, and I could not be happier with where I am. I am so fortunate. I have the best readers in the world. I get to write what I love to write, and I write a lot of things that a lot of authors don't because it's scary and it doesn't always sell. And so I just feel blessed to be able to do that, to write what I like to write, and to have found people who also enjoy it.
So that's one thing I like to ask too, is there a trope which you are not afraid to visit some less than enthusiastic like tropes? Is there a trope you would never write?
I don't know that I could ever say never at this point, because I used to say I would never write an accidental pregnancy book, and then I wrote one and I loved it. So I don't know. Off the top of my head, there's nothing I can think of that I would never write. I will say I don't see myself in this current time ever writing like a really dark romance in the sense of gore. Like I've tried to read a couple of books that are really popular right now, and I want to read them, but the minute someone starts getting like killed or tortured on page, I'm out. So, I don't see that happening for me anytime
Well, I mean, it happens.
soon.
Do you have a trope that you love to write?
Oh, fake anything, fake dating, fake engagement, fake marriage, anytime where they're like, quote unquote, pretending, but really there's some real feelings developing. I eat
That's
that
the
up.
thing,
That's
they're
like my
never
cabin.
pretending.
They're
They're
never
never pretending.
pretending. And it's so, to me, it's so juicy. I know we'll get to it in a little bit, but when we talk about Save Your Breath, that was my favorite part about writing it, is there's just endless opportunity to put them together in these really tension-filled situations, and I can't get enough of that stuff.
So in Save Your Breath, there's a decent amount of miscommunication. Is that a theme throughout all of your books? And do you think
Not
it's
all of them.
necessary?
Not all of them. And I definitely, for me, miscommunication has to be the right couple and it has to make sense. Otherwise, it's frustrating, right? Like, if you have miscommunication that is just there as a plot device, it feels hollow. It pisses the reader off. It makes you just want to scream and throw your Kindle across the room. And I don't want to ever use miscommunication like that. One place where I think it does add emotional impact is in a situation like with Mia and Alex, where Alex has this sort of tortured background story where he doesn't feel great about himself and never has. So he has a hard time communicating, period, not just with her, but with anybody. And then Mia tried to communicate with him when she was younger by, being like, hey, I want to make out. And he
And got
turned her
shot down.
down. Yeah, he turned her down. So she now is scared to communicate again because she's like, even if I thought for sure he felt something back then and he didn't. So clearly I'm reading all the signs wrong. So for these characters, it makes sense and it adds to their story in a way that I think it makes the story richer. But I am not a huge fan of miscommunication trope if it is not done with purpose. If it's just done as a way to keep them apart, I'm not down for that.
I mean, I have to agree. I like miscommunication in a book, but sometimes it just seems misplaced. But I mean, I feel like that goes with really anything. Like there are tropes that people put in a book, and it's like, why was that added in there? It doesn't really make sense here. But
Totally. And I think you can tell, right? I mean, for me, I think there's a difference between writing a book the way or telling a story the way that it's supposed to be told, the way it's speaking to you, and then trying to write a book to market. That is, in my opinion, never going to work out well, just because if you're trying to think of what tropes are popular or what's hot and like shove it all into a book, it's the readers feel that. It feels gimmicky. It feels not authentic. It's like, wait, why
Well,
are we suddenly forcing them into one bed together? Like,
and it
was
feels very
that necessary?
overwhelming. Like it's overwhelming as a reader when they're just jamming all these different tropes, and it's like there's a time and a place for a trope, and it's like the trope should come naturally from the story, not be pushed.
100%. And I love a good, for me, you can almost sell me more with micro tropes, like little things that aren't really a trope, but are, I don't know, things that happen. Like in Save Your Breath, a micro trope that happens that I didn't plan on happening. It just, I was writing the scene and it ended up coming out this way. But she's like hungry and hasn't eaten and is kind of like, oh, whatever, I don't need to eat. I'm just gonna go
Oh,
to bed. And
he constantly is feeding her,
he's like, let
like
me feed
making
you.
sure she eats.
And why is it so hot, Leah? Why is it so hot?
There's just something about it where it's like it's the little things where like they show so much care. But so I was reading Marie, it's a Walker Rose book, but it's her one of her newest ones in her Bourbon Canyon series. And so they sit on Saturday nights, and she reads books, and he paints his Warhammer figurines. I don't know if you know what that is, but that's like their thing. And I'm like, I love that so much. It's just like a quiet, like something they did, like during their fake relationship, they'd sit and like she'd read, and he'd paint Warhammer. And it's also like really showing their nerd. And I just love that so much.
Amazing. I'm such a goner for nerds in books too. I mean, in real life as well. The nerdier, the better, in my opinion.
I mean, I like a nerd. My husband was a, although my husband is not real nerdy. He's like a big burly like ex-football player, but he's very soft-spoken, so like he kind of is comes across as nerdy. Like his
Oh.
voice, I love him dearly, but his voice doesn't really match his body. Like he speaks and you're like, "Wow, that is like a really gentle voice coming out of that."
I definitely married a nerd and I would marry him three times over. I just, everything about him. And I'm like, we have our nights where I sit and read and he either plays his video games or builds his Legos and it's great.
We do that too. So, Well, and actually, when we were dating, this is gonna sound real bad, but we would go to his best friend's house. He would sit in the basement, and his best friend still lived with his parents at the time because we were all in college. They would sit in the basement and play video games, and I would hang out with his best friend's parents. Like
Love
that's
it.
what we would do on the weekends. It's like we are giant losers, but this is what we're doing.
It
But it
works, man.
worked.
If it works for you, it works for you.
It did. So, is there a bucket list subgenre that you would want to write in?
Yeah, I want to write a psychological thriller so bad.
Yeah.
I love to read and watch psychological thrillers. And I just my brain is a little twisted like that. And I love when you're reading a book and you question if you are crazy because you're following a narrator who maybe is a little bit unreliable, but you find yourself identifying with them and you're like, this could be me. I could be this person. But the thing with, in my opinion, with a psychological thriller is you need a really brilliant idea or a really brilliant twist on a common idea to pull it off. And I don't have either yet. So for me, I'm just waiting for the universe to deliver that
That
idea to
aha
me.
moment. Maybe now that like you're manifesting into the universe, it'll come to you.
I hope so. My doors are wide open. I'm just waiting for the idea. Usually my really big ideas hit me as I'm falling asleep and or in the middle of the night. And so I will hop up out of bed, grab my phone, jot down notes really quickly. If it's a really big idea that I feel like I have to write part of it, I'll run up to my office real quick. So I'm just waiting for that night to happen.
I mean, we sometimes get our best ideas in the shower. Like, I'll get random texts from Becky. She's like, shower idea. It's like, please stop texting me from the shower. She's like, but if I don't text you, I'll forget. I'm like,
That's
wait, why do you
exactly
have to
it.
text me? Like, you have an entire house full of people you could text. She's like, I
Just gotta
have to
text
text
you.
you.
Yeah, I always have my phone with me when I take baths. Baths are my thing. I'm such a bath girly. And if you read any of my books, they almost always include a bath in some way. And I always have my phone on me because inevitably I know I'm going to get a book idea and I have to write it down. I have learned my lesson. There have been times I've been falling asleep, something hits me, and I say, surely I will remember this. And I will repeat it over in my head a few times to be like, don't forget this, don't forget this, don't forget this. I
And the
wake up the
minute you
next
wake up.
morning. It is like my brain immediately trashed that thought. As soon as I went to sleep, they were like, don't need that.
That was not important. Did not compute.
Exactly.
Excuse me. Can you share any writing rituals or habits that help you stay focused?
Yeah, definitely. I will say my writing rituals and habits have changed tremendously over the 11 years that I've been publishing now. It looked so different in the beginning because I used to work full-time job and also teach group fitness. So I was writing at night usually from maybe 9 to midnight. And then, scrapping together whatever free hours I could on the weekend when I was single and freshly divorced. I was more of a right in the middle of the day type gal because I was going out a lot and sleeping in late and just living a different life. But currently, right now, where I am in a very healthy, lovely marriage with a brand new baby, I usually wake up around 5 or 5:30 in the morning to pump, and then I immediately go sit down and try to get 45 minutes to an hour of writing in before Rosie wakes up. And this is really important for me to start my day that way because I'm freshest in the mornings. And while my brain is sharp, I need to get started. Otherwise, I don't know, something in my brain just turns off at like 11 a.m. And if I have
So
not started writing,
you're one of those psycho morning people, aren't
and I
you?
did not used to be. I used to be a night owl. I used to write, until 2, 3 in the morning. But then I met my husband, and he is one of those psycho morning people, and he has converted me. He's converted me. So that's part of it. And then I also use I list I used to listen to music, and I used to listen to film scores primarily. But now I listen to Brain FM, which is an incredible tool. If you are a writer or just someone who works in a creative field that you feel like you need to focus and you have a hard time, you can set a timer on there and it's like brain music. It's like it tickles my brain in the way it needs to be tickled to focus. And I will get so much done, so much written in a 45-minute or hour sprint by using that app. So it's brain.fm, if anyone is curious to look that up. And then, other than that, I mean, the only thing I can think of that's really a ritual is that if I'm writing a spicy scene, I have to have a candle lit. I don't know why. I just set the mood, I guess. I really like to have a candle lit when that's the
Hey, whatever works.
vibe.
So, I mean, are you more of a sprinter now that you have Rosie? Or have
Oh,
you
for sure,
always been
but
a like more of a sprinter?
I have been a sprinter for a long time, even before I knew what sprinting was, I think, because I just, when I was younger, I only had a certain amount of time to work with. So I was like, okay, I have 2 hours before I've got to get some sleep because I have to be at work in the morning. So I'm just going to do whatever I can in these 2 hours and I'm not moving from this spot. Now it's more like for me, 45 minutes is like my sweet spot. So I'll set a 45-minute timer. And then once that timer is done in the morning, I go feed Rosie, I feed myself, and I'm probably not sitting back down for another hour. And then I'll do another 45-minute timer, and then, something else has to be taken care of. So I'm writing in those little sprint pockets now, which is great. It's working great for me because I have that 45 minutes to an hour of intense focus, and then I sort of get to like walk around and like move my body, which is really important too.
Do you plot out your books or are you a pantser?
A little bit of
Are you
both.
like a blend?
Yeah, I'm definitely a blend. I'm much more into plotting now than I was when I was younger. Like, for instance, A Love Letter to Whiskey was not plotted. I did not plan a single thing for that book other than the scene that jumped out at me that made me want to write this book is the one where he shows up on her doorstep, drenched, and has her wedding invitation in his hand. And it's like, you're not marrying him. You're not marrying anybody but me. And that's all I knew going into that book. And I just started writing. So that was a completely pantsed book. But then if you look at my more recent books and where I am now in my career, I 100% plot because I need to know where I'm going. It makes me feel so much more confident as a writer to know where I'm going. And I'm also usually planning out an entire series, not just one book. So it gets really messy if you don't have a plan. So I definitely plot a lot more now.
Now, do you plot like tightly or is it just kind of like a loose, like these are the characters, this is like where I want them to end up type of plotting? Because I know there are some authors who like they're very stringent, like strict outline, and some who like it's a very loose plot, like they know point A to point B or point A and point B, but they do not know the journey there.
Totally. I think I'm a little bit of a blend of that one too. I would say I'm more on the strict side of plotting. Like, I like to have my big points, right? My point A, B, and C. But then I will go back and be like, okay, what do I need to develop and uncover in this time? How am I going to build tension here? What are the steps to reveal this character's backstory without it being an info dump and things like that? I think because I have less time in general as a mom now, I feel so much more confident writing if I sit down and I look at my notes and I have a clear direction of what I'm writing in that scene. If it's like, hey, as if I'm talking to myself, if I open up a plot or my little outline and it says, this is the scene where they have their first fake kiss. It is moving the story along in this way. This is the character plot point that you need to develop here. Here's the feeling, whatever. Then I know exactly what I'm doing when I jump in, and I can make the most of that hour that I have.
Do you find it difficult to balance the romantic arc with the other elements of the story?
No, but I will say, I think depending on the book, sometimes like the romance or the spice is more of front and center, and then other times the characters and their story are, and I just never know what it's going to be until I'm in it. Like, just speaking about the current hockey series that I'm in, the first book is very much like fun, spicy. It's like their banter, they're silly. There's nothing really heavy in that book. Book two, though, both characters have some heavy things that they're fighting through, and they're on a road trip together, so there's lots of room for them to talk and kind of discover more about themselves. So it does get very spicy, but it's a slow burn to get there. Book three was spicy lessons. So again, fun banter. He's a grumpy single dad goalie, and she's like this sunshiny kindergarten teacher. So very fun and light. And then you get to book four, and it's a little bit heavier. Alex has a heavier background. Mia is, struggling with her self-confidence as one of the biggest pop stars in the world. And they have all this history between them. So, again, more of a slow burn, more of that relationship building before you get to the spice. So, I guess everything just has to depend for me on the characters. And that's always going to be the biggest driver for me. Like, I plot, but most of my plotting is character development because that's where I go with my stories. I let the characters take over.
Well, and on that note, let's go ahead and talk about Save Your Breath, which is book four in the Ice King series. It releases March 20th, 2025. The tropes are childhood friends to lovers, fake relationship, sports. It is in the hockey world, and it is a slow burn. So Alex himself is a pro hockey player. He's a little bit of an angry man.
Just a little.
And then we have Mia Conaway, who, but to her fans, she is Mia Love. These two met when they were much younger, when Alex came to live with Mia's parents, because he is from, drawing a
Switzerland.
blank, Switzerland. Thank you. Sorry, I wrote it down somewhere, but I can't find that note.
No worries.
So he came to live with them to play hockey in the States, and like they became very good friends, like feelings started, but then it kind of failed miserably for Mia. And things were not really the same after that. They were, but they weren't.
Totally. Yes. So, yeah, it's definitely the childhood friends to lovers, but kind of with a twist because they don't grow up together. He comes in, he moves in with them when he's 16, I believe. And Mia's 16 as well. So the last 2 years of high school, right? A very formidable time in our life. Lots of hormones going,
Oh, yeah.
lots of
On both sides,
discovering.
yeah.
Yes, on both sides. And what Mia doesn't know is that, reasonably so, her father has sort of given Alex a warning to not behave in any inappropriate way with his daughter, which totally makes sense. Like, here's this man who is inviting a hockey player to live with him and his family, including his teenage daughter. And he's like, don't make me regret this. Like, show respect for me and my family. There's a boundary there. Mia has no idea this has happened, though. And so she makes a move and gets turned down and feels so rejected. Alex feels terrible because he doesn't want to reject her. And when they're finally old enough and he moves out, it's too late. She has moved on. Her career is taking off. His is taking off. And the time that he does finally kind of like get the guts to be like, no, I'm going to go get the girl, he flies to LA to surprise her and she is dating someone else. So, sort of that right person, wrong time. And it leads to where we are now. And they're in a
I will say though, that scene when like we go back to it and he is talking about it, like that's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot. I mean, he wanted so badly to tell her the truth of how he was feeling, and it's very similar. Like, she gets the guts to try to kiss him, gets turned down. He finally gets the guts to tell her how he feels, and she's moved on with a guy who could not be more opposite from Alex. And so he's like, of course she's not gonna be with me. Like, she wants the good boy athlete who's gonna, be a charity, someone who's charitable and lovely and all these things.
Well, and that was kind of like her path. Like every guy she dated was like the complete opposite. And I mean, there was purpose to that on her part.
100%, right? She's dating all the good boys, the golden boys. And so Alex, understandably so, is like, well, I am not her type. And then Alex is like never dating anyone. He's like one night stands with these hot supermodels. And Mia has always been identified as like cute and the girl next door. And so she's like, I am not his type. And again, it's that miscommunication trope, but it makes sense. And as you're reading through it, you're like, I can totally see how this all led to this situation. But now they find themselves in like a mutual PR stunt to shape up both of their reputations and pretend to not just date each other, but get engaged. And oh man, it's really hard to hide your feelings when you got to get down on one knee and propose.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's this situation where like they're trying to show that her ex is a troll and like a whore, like is supposedly this nice guy, but he's really not, and that they want to show that Alex is human and has feelings besides like being mad at everybody in the world. And so it works in both their favors, but there were times where I'm like, man, like my heart broke, because especially during the proposal scene,
Oh, it's
like
rough.
it was rough. Like I read that and I'm like, oh no, what's gonna happen?
My
Because
heart.
he's so heartfelt and truthful in what he's saying, but she doesn't realize it, and he like doesn't realize that she doesn't realize, and there's just so much like I don't know that he knows that I know type of thing going on. And
Yeah.
Man, it was heartbreaking because she was like, why would he do this way?
Yes, she's upset. She's like angry with him. She's like, how could you say those things to me and make it feel so real? Like it feels cruel to her, right? And she doesn't find out until, of course, like oh, my favorite moment in a slow burn or like a miscommunication when everything comes to the surface. And he just has the moment of, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a moment where
There's a
you like,
moment.
there's a moment, a big moment. And to me, that's what makes a slow burn worth it. Like, I love the mutual pining and the tension and all of that. And the reason I love it is because once you finally get to that point where they both give in and all the truth comes out, it's so satisfying. It's so satisfying.
Well, and it's one of those mutual pinings where, like, they both were out living their lives. They were not, like, beholden to their feelings. And there wasn't, like, they weren't stagnant in, I mean, they were stagnant in their, like, feelings, but they were not stagnant in living. And that's one thing I liked about it is because there are so often mutual pinings where one of them is off doing their thing, but it's always been you. And the other one is not doing anything, but it's always been you. And it bugs me so much. And people harp on me on the podcast about it because I'm like, if the dude can go off being a hoe, why is she not? Like, allow her hoe phase. Like,
100%.
or like, let her be the hoe and have him be celibate. Like, why does
Yes.
the dude always get to screw everybody?
Oh, I will tell you, that is one of my biggest pet peeves as an author, and I have to like remind myself of this, that typically readers are harder on our female main characters than
Oh, so
our,
much.
like, it's bad, and it's awful because I have so many characters that I've written who I love and adore, and I think they're so badass, and they will get ripped to shreds in reviews because they don't do what,
Is
whoever the reader
expected.
is. Yes. And it's like they can't have any faults. They can't like be upset over an ex. They can't be heartbroken. They can't be messed up from their childhood. They can't go have a hoe phase. They can't have any of these things that when we do it with a male character, we eat it
It's
up,
fine.
right?
It's
Like,
fine.
it makes no sense
Nothing bugs me more. And it's
to me.
something I will stand on my soapbox and preach it to the choir because it drives me insane.
Me too. I mean, one of my most popular books is A Love Letter to Whiskey, and so many readers hate B and they rip her to shreds because she chooses so many things in her life over Jamie. She chooses her family. She chooses giving her time, giving herself time to grieve and process and heal something that happens to her. She chooses her internship and eventually her job. And I'm like, guys, why is it that she has to give everything up for him? Like, Jamie never volunteers to leave his job and go move to where she is, and no one's throwing a fit about that. Like, I don't know. So,
Well, and my thing too, like when like there's a breakup and it's clearly like the dude's fault, like she's almost expected to grovel.
yeah, like
It's
what?
like she didn't do anything wrong. Although I do enjoy a good heroine grovel when she's the one who fucks up.
Oh, me too. I have one of those in the right player, and it was my favorite. It, like, she does the grand gesture, and it makes me
Oh
so
yeah.
happy. Mm-hmm.
And it sometimes I love that, but it has to just make sense.
Totally.
But Alex himself, like he has a pretty harsh background. Like he has lived in foster care. He had addicts for parents. Like he's a little bit emotionally stunted because of these things. But like Mia's family really like took him under their wing and care for him and love him. And like they have a good relationship with him still, which I thought was very like well done and important to the story. Like, yes, his dad, or like, not his dad, her dad was like, I want you to take a step back. But I mean, they were both young. Like, he was looking out for their well-being, but Alex took that shit to heart.
He did. He did. Yeah. I mean, his background is so important to who he is, and I wanted to make sure that that was exposed because he's not just like this bad boy who's constantly getting into fights and like being a jerk because he's an asshole. He, like you said, is emotionally stunted. And if anybody here is a fan of the Enneagram personality test, he is an Enneagram 4. So if you know anything about Enneagram, you can kind of gather a little bit about who he is. But Enneagram fours are usually like sort of quiet and reserved and emo, and they sort of believe that no one could ever understand them because no one's ever been through what they've been through, and they feel very isolated. And but typically, when they find someone that gets their trust, that's their person forever and ever, right? And so that's Mia for him. When they were kids, and she sort of gained his trust and kept it and was just this rock for him at such an unstable time in his life. And same with her parents, though it's always going to be true for him. So you can see, like, he even says many times, you know, he doesn't have any friends. There's nothing that really keeps him going other than Mia, really.
Well, it's one of those things where, like, when they're first introduced, like, they see Alex as Alex. Like, it's not this troubled kid. It's just this kid who's coming to live with them, who's like, they're going to make the best of the situation. And you don't always get that. And I think that was really nice on your part that you, like, chose that direction. Like, there wasn't this separation. 'Cause, I mean, having a random kid come and live with you, like, that has to be tough. And it happens all the time, like, with, like the different teams and stuff that are across the country. They have a name, but I can't think of what it is right off the
The
top of
billet
my head.
families.
The Billet families. Yes.
Yes.
I was thinking farm families. I'm like, that is not right. So I'm not gonna go with it. And so, like, with that, like, whole situation, like, it's like you're welcoming like a random kid. And like, yes, there's a purpose and a reasoning for it, but it's like you never know what you're gonna get. But that was something too, is Alex moved in and he did not like push his insecurities onto them. Like, he did stay like closed off in some senses, but he didn't at the same time. And it's like they saw him for who he was, and he recognized that, especially during the scene we were talking about earlier, like when her dad like went and talked to him because he knew what was going on. It's like, and it cleared a lot of stuff up for him, but he's still like, there's so much self-doubt there.
100%, 100%. And he feels like no matter how well he does at hockey or how much he proves himself to Mia's dad or Mia, that he is always going to have like this dark piece of himself that he can't ever get rid of. And he is a firm believer that his parents live within him and that he sort of can't escape that part of himself. And that is his battle, his internal battle throughout this entire thing, and something that he has to actively fight to overcome, even after they're together in the end.
Well, but any kid of like addiction has those thoughts, like whether or not like they are the ones with the addictive personality, will they be going down that same path, or are they
Oh.
going to be the ones to break it?
100%. I mean, my father is an addict, my brother is an addict, and I've seen front and center what it can do to someone's life. And for those, like, I have had surgeries where I've been prescribed painkillers after, like hydrocodone and things, and I won't take them because I'm so scared. I'm so scared that I will become addicted, and so I just won't even touch it. And sometimes I will stop myself even before something is an issue. Like, I'll be like, oh my gosh, I have been shopping too much lately. I'm becoming an addict. I need to pull it back. And I'm just hyper aware of those things. And Alex is too. Like, he is very well aware when things feel dark and scary, how easy it is to numb himself with women or with alcohol or hockey. Like, hockey, positive things can be an addiction too, like working out or whatever the case may be. Anything that takes over your life in that way, right? And so he's very, very aware of sort of that
Well,
role.
and he makes kind of a throwaway comment towards the beginning of the book about how like he pursues like the safer addictions, like the women, the hockey, the booze to a point. Like he made a statement about how it's like he knew how far he could take it before he had to pull back again, which I felt was very accurate.
Yes. And he has this moment, right? Like, it's a flashback, and we get to see it when he goes home and sees Mia with Austin, who is her prick ex-boyfriend, right? That we're doing the whole publicity stunt for. But the first time that Alex sees them together, he is like unable to hold himself together. It is so heartbreaking for him. On top of the fact that he's not doing well in the hockey world, there's just a lot of things going on, and it's the first time he finds himself in a truly tricky situation as someone who's battled with this because he debates taking a bottle of pills. And it's this really big moment in his life that fortunately Mia and her father were both there to sort of help him through. But it's a big pivotal moment for them, you know?
So what's next?
What's next after this? Oh man. So I'm working on a standalone that I'll be releasing at the beginning of next year with Keeperton slash Arendelle, which is my publisher that just signed with me this year. Very exciting stuff. That will be up my, like, if you love my angst and my sort of toxic stories, this is going to be right up your alley. And then I have the last two books in the hockey series. So at the end of Save Your Breath, you're going to get a sneak peek into Stand Your Ground, which is Carter and Livy's book. And then Coach is the final book, which will come out next summer.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I've enjoyed talking to you immensely about this in your craft.
Yeah, same. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And anybody who's listening, I'm everywhere you are on social media. So if you want to hang out online and be friends, you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, all the places.
Right. And until next time, happy reading, everybody.
Find us on Instagram at Buzzing About Romance or on Twitter at Buzzing Romance. If you like the podcast, please leave a review. If you'd like to support us directly, join the Bookcase and Coffee Patreon and receive exclusive content only available to Patreon members. Check out bookcaseandcoffee.com for our on-the-shelf show notes.